Good morning. I do believe that one of the toughest jobs in the city and in the county and probably all over the nation is to go on with drug law enforcement with such limited resources and so much historical and other baggage that we really are dealing with. But it's also my unenviable task this morning to talk about just that, and in particular the Seattle Police Department, not necessarily because it is the example of problematic law enforcement tactics that have been going on, but because it happens to be in the city of Seattle where we are. I am here to talk about more specifically the discretionary decisions that are made at some of the critical stage junctures in criminal justice system, but more in particular, way upstream at the arrest stage and even slightly pre-arrest stage. The reason is that many reports, and I know Roger has also mentioned that our 1999 state report, along with many other reports, have continuously indicated that, you know, we keep looking at these sentencing disparities, we keep looking at these charging disparities, and yet, you know, because of this mandatory sentencing law that we've been working with, and because no individual prosecutor or a judge has that much discretion at each juncture, that it really, that the problem must be somewhere else, somewhere upstream. After all, as they say, prosecutors can only charge only those cases that the law enforcement officers bring to them, and the judges would then come and say, yeah, I can only sentence those that have been convicted as a result of filing by the prosecution. You know, there are some problems with each and every one of those, you know, a little bit too fast and simple explanation, but let's just, you know, so be it for the time being. So what is the problem then upstream, way up there with the way the law enforcement strategies have been deployed, particularly in the city of Seattle? All of the data that we have been looking at, and these are all published official public health or court records. All of the data that we have been looking at indicate this. The biggest racial and class disparity that is apparent in drug law enforcement statistics seems to come from those law enforcement operations that employ the highest level of discretions, namely things like undercover operations, and namely, and most specifically, by bust operations where undercover officers actually go out to look for drugs from people who would be willing to either deliver or sell to them. Let's also be clear about a couple other things while we are at it. Some close to 90% of those drug arrests that are called drug trafficking or drug offense arrests in the city are what's called small street level drug offenses. When we say small levels, for those of you who are not familiar with criminal justice system and drug laws in particular, we're really talking about small levels. For instance, it is very, very common for the in most cases, you're looking at a speck, just a little tiny piece of something that a person would be using for one use at the most. In other cases, it's not even that. So nearly all of the drug arrests we're talking about are small level. The other very distinct part about all this is that nearly all of these are what's called public sales or public consumption. They are at the street level. And so by the definition of street level, by the definition of small level transactions, we are now really getting into the implications of race and class in drug law enforcement here. Now, what do we mean by, you know, disparity? I know we've been talking about disparity a lot from all of the numbers that we're looking at this morning. at one point, I know Roger was talking about in the state, African Americans were 6.6 times more likely than a white to be arrested for a drug offense, and in King County was like 10 times. Well, the latest official figure that we have for the city of Seattle is 22 times. 22 times. So what do we mean by this 22 times, six times, and 10 times racial disparity? As you know, in the city of Seattle, about 8% of the population is African American, and about 57% of the latest figures would indicate that African Americans, 57% of the drug arrests were African Americans. So 22 times actually comes from that. Now, some of you, I'm sure, would think that that does not quite seem convincing if you're just comparing the regular population versus the data for, you know, available data for arrests and conviction and such data. Well, then I guess the ideal thing would be to know just exactly how many people in the city of Seattle, for instance, are truly committing drug law offense, and then how many are actually being arrested. Well, that's not going to come by, and that kind of figure is nowhere, anywhere that I know of in any city or state. But what's very close to that is what's been quite reliably, good indicia of the estimated potential offenders, and those are people who are drug users, and you've been hearing about a lot of numbers about drug users. Those drug users are possessors, and drug possession is a felony crime. And drug possession also, at the least, is drug possession, and that also involves delivery and sales from one of the parties or some of the parties involved in the transaction. Looking at all of the indicia, that includes the Department of Alcohol and Substance Abuse, that includes overdose rates, emergency mentions, several other King County specific, but also touching on the Seattle area, public health records indicate that includes the jail inmates' use record as well. They are all incredibly consistent with the national data, the state data, county data, and in most cases actually higher, more stark. In the case of heroin, for instance, according to the needle exchange data, the client population in the downtown core is more like 38% black, but in Capitol Hill or in Broadway, 98 and 99% white, respectively. Those are startling figures. So getting back to the issue of discretion, just what is happening upstream that accounts for this kind of stark, incredible, gross disparity? There seem to be like two unwritten models or goals of the police department that is admittedly, lacking resources and a clear mandate from the nation and from the state. And that is, go where visible complaints and problems are. And number two, do the kind of operation that would help prosecution prosecute properly. So, first of all, visible drugs, that would be only those complaints where they actually would produce a very easy to go out and target, not necessarily because they are particular demographics, but because they are easy to target. Now, that's what the police, every police officer and every unit commander will tell you, that we do not go out and specifically target any particular demographic or social class, but that is the easiest place to go and get the arrests. There's a real problem with that, but I do know that they believe that that is the case. The other thing is, because they use undercover operations, it involves 10 to 12 officers in uniform and also undercover. They make traditionally very credible witnesses at trial and at sentencing. And so it's convenient, it's well done, and it's productive. What else can you do as law enforcement officers within what they perceive as limited resources? Well, I think there are a lot of things, but for the most part, because they are lacking the mandate, clear sense of what their goals are, they are obviously completely ignoring the entire problem of what drugs, if there are drug problems that are really infesting all of the communities, all of these other communities that are, you know, white populated communities are not being the recipient of this benefit of drug arrest. They're also not being sent to any proper, through proper channels for any kind of drug treatment. But, you know, here is the biggest thing about the systemic problem. Granted that the disparity seems to truly start way upstream, does that then mean that's the end of the problem? Prosecution can just throw off their hands and judges can throw off their hands and say, look, what can we do? We're just here, the recipients of these high numbers that are coming in. You know, here's another way of looking at it. We all know that it's not necessarily drug law enforcement, but it's really more like quality of life enforcement. What that means is that law enforcement is going out there trying to do what they think they can to stem a tide of not drug problems, but the complaints, citizens' complaints, and any other less civilized way of doing drugs in the city. Well, if we understand that, and in addition, if we also understand that we're all swimming in this muck of historical legacy of racism and our own stereotypes about social class, if we understand that as well, then all of us in criminal justice system, it must be responsible. It behooves all of us to look at each system and say, look, so these numbers are coming to me at the filing stage, at the sentencing stage. What do we do about this? Well, since it's not necessarily drug law enforcement, and since this does not necessarily represent all or not even half of the reality of the market out there and drug problems, we should deal with it at that level, not according to the statutory, not according to the other drug law policy that so far has not been working, but it's in the book. At the sentencing level as well, for those African-Americans and people of limited means who come back again and again with prior history, instead of just looking at that as these are repeat offenders, what can we do about this? Well, what if you look at that, again, not as a felony drug law problem, but as a repetition of the same problem that goes on and on and on at upstream? I think it behooves all of us, yet again, to look at this at each juncture and say, we have the discretion to look at this, and we have the responsibility to do something about it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Casey. Here's Karen Murray.
Thank you. I wonder how many of you have heard about a book called Doesn't It Make You Want to Holler? Black folks use that term a lot. And every time I sit and listen to this thing on race and class disparity in the criminal justice system and actually listen to the statistics and actually listen to the stories, sometimes I just want to holler. It is my privilege to introduce to you the first panel discussion this morning on racial disparity in the criminal justice system and the war on drugs. The moderator for this panel discussion will be Ms. Deborah Peterson Small. Ms. Small is a native New Yorker and a proud graduate of the City College of New York and a Harvard Law School graduate. Before assuming her current position at the Drug Policy Alliance, She was legislative director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. It was during this period that she became an ardent advocate for drug policy reform. As she became increasingly aware of the number of young black men and women incarcerated for drug offenses, she is regularly privileged to speak to the public, elected officials, and religious and community leaders, as well as parents, about issues relating to our government's failed drug policy. Ms. Small, thank you for taking time out of probably a very busy schedule. Thanks for being with us today. Next to Ms. Small is panelist Lisa Dugard. Earlier I stated that she was the staff attorney with the Defenders Association and also member of the Racial Disparity Project. Personally, I just want to say that I have watched and learned many things from her, and I am very proud to call her a colleague and a friend. I now will turn over the panel to Ms. Small, who will now moderate this discussion. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm really, really happy to be here and proud to have the opportunity to be part of what I think is going to be a groundbreaking effort here in Washington State. You all are directly across from my home state of New York, where people used to think that progressive politics originated. But as I get more and more involved in political activity on a national level, I realize that innovation is really coming more from the West, and that those of us on the East are looking to you for guidance, for support, and for showing us a better way of doing some things than we've been doing up till now. I just want to raise three issues to provide a context for the discussion that we're going to have today. And I want to pick up on the theme that was started by Councilman Larry Gossett in his remarks earlier on, where he said some things that were deliberately designed to provoke people because he wanted to generate more in-depth conversation around these issues. So the question that I want to add to the one that he raised is the war on drugs really about drugs? Or is it a social policy designed to accomplish other more covert goals? I believe that some of the evidence that you've heard this morning suggests that, in fact, our drug war has less to do with limiting the use, distribution, or abuse of the substances that we've made illegal because we've only applied it to small populations, and more to continue a policy of racial and class oppression and subjugation that's existed from the beginning of the country. And as further evidence of that, I want to just raise three issues that we didn't talk about in talking about the statistics related to racial disparities in the criminal justice system, because I think it's important for people to understand that the implications of the drug war don't just begin and end with the criminal justice system, but they have to do with lots of other areas of life that people should care about. So one thing that you want to think about is that drug-related AIDS is the leading cause of death in many minority communities today, particularly in African American and Latino communities, and that these are deaths that are completely preventable. I'll just say to you that in my state of New York, at one point less than 10 years ago, 50% of all injection drug users were infected with HIV. We think we've made major progress because we got that statistic down from 50% to 30%. But when you go abroad and go to places like England and Germany and Australia and other countries that adopted interventions early on in the epidemic, Australia, which has a heroin problem that rivals that in the worst city in the U.S., has never had more than 5% of their injection drug users infected with HIV/AIDS. Ever in the history of the epidemic. And that's because they early on adopted interventions like increasing availability of clean syringes, providing health services to active drug users, and support to them in order to reduce the spread of HIV/AIDS. And that's had a significant impact on the epidemic in that country. Secondly, political implications. You know, our last election showed us the consequence of what happens when huge numbers of the population are disenfranchised as a result of felony convictions, oftentimes as a result of their involvement in drugs. In states all along the South and going as far west as Texas, almost a third of all African American men are not able to vote because of drug-related felony convictions. And I don't think I'd be exaggerating in saying that we'd have a very different political scene in our country today and in many of our states if those citizens of the U.S. were allowed to participate in our democratic form of government. And then the final issue I want to raise has to do with the economic one. You know, we went through a period in the 90s where our economy was acclaimed across the world as being a vibrant, growing economy, because, and one of the indications of that was our low unemployment rate. But I want to say to you and suggest to you that our high incarceration rate puts a lie to our low unemployment rate, because people who are incarcerated are not considered to be in the labor force. Neither are people who are in our county jails and under other forms of criminal justice supervision. So what do you think it would have meant to the projections about our economic growth if those 4 million people who are in prison, who are in county jails, and in other forms of criminal justice supervision were counted among the ones as being unemployed? And the final thing I want to say about that is that we're giving a negative lesson to the rest of the world. We're teaching other countries that one way that you can appear to have a healthy economy and disappear your social problems is by locking them away in penitentiaries. I don't think that that's consistent with a country that claims it wants to be a beacon of freedom. So that's all I want to say, and I'm really, really happy to be here with the other panelists, and I'm going to turn it over now to
I think the thing that I want to take away from the statistical and other presentations that we heard this morning, earlier this morning, is this, that locally there is clearly a phantom population of white drug offenders who will never become acquainted with the downside and the upsides, such as they are, of the criminal justice system. And that's the topic that I want to focus on in my brief remarks. I know that everybody wants to talk to the panel, so I'll be very quick. This disparity that is kind of the starting point for our discussion today, there's a temptation in a panel such as this to have the conversation focus on the question, whose fault is it? And Dan alluded to that, to feeling like that's kind of the framework for this panel. So I want to posit that what if it's all of our fault? What if it isn't John's fault? And what if it isn't Dan's fault? And what if one just assumes, for the sake of argument, very good intentions on the part of law enforcement, on the part of prosecutors, on the part of judges? I'm not saying that that's true. I'm saying let's just assume for the sake of this discussion that it is. And I'm not saying that it's not. We have differences of opinion about that in this room. Let's set that question aside and just say, what if it's not those individual people's intention or fault that we're in the situation that we're in? And I want to ask, what difference does that really make? What if it's just all of our fault? I want to propose a test for any way that we as a society and we as a local community decide to go forward on drug policy. And that is this, that if we're doing something worth doing, if we're doing something worth expending enormous financial and human resources on, if we're doing something good and worth defending, then let's do it to everybody. If we're not going to do that, I think it raises important, perhaps devastating questions to the assumption or the argument that what we're doing is good. Because if we're not willing to do it to everybody, the reason probably is that it's not really a good, constructive, or necessary way to intervene in people's lives. I think it's actually incredibly important for us all, particularly those who participate in critiques of the status quo in drug policy and the way that drugs are treated in the criminal justice system, to acknowledge the tremendous social pressures to which law enforcement and prosecutors, to perhaps a lesser extent, and even judges are responding. And this is why I say, what if it's all of our fault? Perhaps you all have read or heard that ecstasy is the new crack. Has anybody heard this? Ecstasy is, a club drug. It's a drug in very widespread usage among middle class, upper middle class, and white citizens, white residents of our community. It's very popular. Recently, we've been told by public health experts and law enforcement experts that it's very dangerous, that it constitutes a profound public health threat. Well, I just want everybody to watch and see what happens. Will we see the type of law enforcement and criminal justice concentration on ecstasy that we saw on crack throughout the 80s and the 90s? And if we don't see that, why is that? Because we're being told now that there's no substantive reason to distinguish between those drugs in terms of the harm that they do, both to society and to the individual user. The Seattle Police Department, which I do have reason to commend on a number of grounds, the Seattle Police Department recently did an undercover buy bust operation in a rave, a huge party in which ecstasy was in common circulation, and arrested 40 or more folks for delivering ecstasy, which is a drug of comparable seriousness to cocaine in terms of our legislative judgments, to cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine. Many of those arrestees were middle class, and most were white. They were medical students, aspiring professionals, people who never expected to be in the criminal justice system, and whom, frankly, many in the criminal justice system never expected to see there either. And when this new initiative was brought, the Seattle City Council was briefed on it, and the police department came and described what they had done and what the results were, and that they could have arrested as many people as they wanted to. 40 was an arbitrary cutoff based on their resources. It was like shooting fish in a barrel, the same way that they described buy bus at 2nd and Pike downtown. In other words, there's just no limit to the yield that you could get in terms of arrests if you wanted to focus there. A member of the Seattle City Council questioned the police representatives who were making this presentation and said, come on, is this really a productive way to be using our public resources? Are these really the people we need to be going after? And I mention this only because I do think there's something to the thesis that it's all of our fault and that it's not terribly productive to focus on law enforcement decisions as if they took place in a vacuum. They are decisions that take place, they are riding the surf of a large ocean, and that ocean is community and public preferences and the way that they're expressed to policymakers and the way that they're expressed in terms of pressure on the department. If that doesn't change, it's both unreasonable and futile for us to expect that police decisions are going to change in a vacuum or in a void. I want to end by also trying to put into question the framework that we seem to be moving toward, where, yes, once you get into the criminal justice system, you may find more therapeutic options available to you than has been the case in the past. This is the movement toward more drug courts, greater drug courts that encompass more kinds of cases, treatment in lieu of jail, treatment in lieu of prison. These are looked at compared to what we had before, these are welcome developments, and we shouldn't just gloss over that. And they do reflect, in a sense, a sea change. Nonetheless, they're still, the access point for that is still getting arrested. And those who never get arrested, as I said at the beginning, never get the benefits of the criminal justice system. If that's how we're going to do things, and if we're not going to change who gets arrested for drug offenses, we are creating a two-track, separate and unequal, way of addressing people's drug usage and drug involvement and drug activity. One is for people who are the focus of law enforcement. They get treatment increasingly, but it is with court supervision, with the threat of jail or prison if they relapse. And it is with the stigma of an arrest, and it is often it is accompanied by a criminal conviction, usually a felony conviction, which, as you'll hear later in the day, carries unending collateral consequences for your ability to get and keep employment, go to school, and get public benefits. Okay, but they're in treatment. The rest of the world gets to go to treatment on their own. And if they relapse, they just go get back in when they're ready. Though it is true that recent studies have shown that so-called coerced treatment within the criminal justice system is not less effective than voluntary treatment, the same studies show that it is not more effective than voluntary treatment. You don't have to put people in that system to see them succeed. What you do have to do is make sure that they have access to the resources to pay for it. Right now, the only place... Right now, the only place in our society where there are subsidies provided to the extent that you don't have to pay anything to get into treatment is once you've been arrested and charged with a felony. That ought not to be the case. So I'd just like to close by saying that though maybe it's nobody's fault coming into this room, once we know what's happening, once we know what we're doing, once we know the human outcome of those choices, if we keep doing it, then it is intentional. It is a choice. It's a choice we don't have to make, and we're all responsible. Thank you.
So now I'm going to start with Dorothy and ask Dorothy to share her story with us and enlighten us about some of the effects of the war on drugs.
First, I'd like to say thank you, and it's truly a blessing to be here because this time 2 years ago, I was sitting in federal prison, not knowing my fate, sentenced to 20 years because I wouldn't snitch on someone. Never sold drugs, never used drugs, never even know what crack cocaine would be without reading about it. But my name is Dorothy Gaines. I'm from Mobile, Alabama. I'm a 44-year-old single mother. And truly, it's a blessing to be here because my first plane ride was with the federal marshals on my way to federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. And as I sit on the plane now, I thank God that I can ride at my own will. Truly, it was a devastating chance getting here last night. Started out at 12 o'clock yesterday from Mobile trying to get here. Was due here at 4 and got here like almost 5, 3-something this morning. But I know God has a mission for my life. My case starts back. My case could go on. I could talk about this for 15 hours, and I know I have a time limit. But I'm so blessed to see so many attorneys and so many people that come out for this cause. I don't like to use the word race. I don't like to use the word war. And I never really faced racism until I got in the judicial system and when I went to federal prison. If it was there, I didn't know it's because I was a person that I love everybody. I don't see color until you come to close the cars. I was back in 1993. I was common law husband to a guy that was a drug user, and by me being a licensed nurse technician, I didn't want to just put him away because he was a drug user, just stay in the relationship. So I did what I could to help this guy, and I put him into drug rehab, and he relapsed. And what happened was a case come down with my oldest child father, Natasha, who's now in pre-law behind what happened to me. She's now starting to be an attorney. My daughter, father held a grudge against me for years because I tried to get child support out of him. I was young and naive at that time and in love, and I found out you could go to prison for being in love. But he held a revenge against me for years, and he had a case to come up on him with guns and weapons and drugs. And I was dating a guy named Terrell, which was my common law husband, so he decided he wanted to get revenge at both of us, so we both went to prison. How this case started out was a state case, and there was no evidence in our case. It was just on the word of a conspirator. And the case was state, they threw the case out. So the federal government picked it up. But they asked me to come downtown and testify against Terrell. And I told them I didn't have any information, that I feel like the government should do their own job. I wasn't going to be a snitch for them. So they told me that if I didn't testify, that I would get indicted. So being naive to the law, I took this as a joke. I went back home. And on this, Terrell went to trial in February. And on the end of April, I saw the FBI. They had come to my house in 93 and tore it up and found nothing. Come back to arrest me and say I had been indicted by the grand jury. So I went downtown. They gave me a lawyer, and I have respect for lawyers. I'm not going to tell you that I don't, because through God, I had gotten a pro bono attorney out of Boston that took my case back in 99 that fought to help me get out of prison. But this lawyer that was in Mobile, I called him a public pretender. This guy actually held my hand for me to get convicted. And how this started out was that he didn't do anything for me for the trial. He knew it was a dry conspiracy, but he wanted me to help the government. And I told him I couldn't help the government. So he said that, well, what you got to do is plead out. I said, I'm not going to plead to something I didn't do. So I went on the trial, and the only time I saw this attorney was the day of the morning of the trial. He walked into the room and said, come on and plead. I said, I can't plead. So he first told me, he said, you know, you're going to have a good chance because here we are in Mobile, Alabama, and all your character witnesses are white. So that looks good for you in Alabama. So I goes to trial, and he told me that he had never heard of a guy testifying for a person that wasn't with him anymore, which Terrell was indicted. They wanted me to testify against him. So I went, so they in turn indicted me and asked Terrell to testify against me. So we went to trial, and the government said, well, you're going to testify against her, we'll give you 50% of your time. He said, no, I'll take my time to the door. I'm not going to lie on her. So we went on the trial, and the government still called Terrell to testify against me. They put him on the stand. And then he told them that she didn't know anything about my conspiracy. It was my child's father that implicated me, testified against me and his mother. His mother done 5 years in federal prison as well, so he could get out of prison. So we went on to prison, and Terrell told him that, no, she didn't do anything. I'm going on to the door at my time. And all this started back, and I went to prison. And I said, well, I'm going to go to prison. I'm going to be like the person in the Bible. I'm going to fight this case. And I ended up getting a lot of publicity. I was in Playboy magazine. I was on PBS Frontline Snitch. I was in Essence magazine. I was in Marie Claire. I was in Jet. I was in People. I hit about 20 newspapers around the world because I wanted people to know this doesn't happen to me. It can happen to you as well. And it was just a miracle case in the courtroom. My lawyer said, well, I know you're going to make sure that you get this time. He was really the prosecutor. I thought he was my attorney, but he was the prosecutor. So after I was convicted that day, I asked him, I said, you know, my mother's dying with cancer. I have 2 children at home that don't. I'm their only living parent. Could you please try and get me a bond? He said, no, I've never heard that a prosecutor, that you would get a bond if you didn't help the government. So I wrote a letter to the judge and asked this judge to give me a bond to go home and see about my dying mother. And the judge called me in with the U.S. with the marshals. He said, Dorothy, I took your letter for a bond, a motion for your bond, and I'm letting you go home today. My lawyer reached over and told me, he said, Dorothy, you taught me something. This has never happened before. So I went on to prison. I went on and got bond, and I fired this public defender. And there were some people that raised me, some white people that raised me in the country when I was a young girl that saw my needs being met. They got me an attorney. But what we don't realize is that if you don't get it right with the trial, it's no help after the conviction. You know, and I went on to trial, and I tell you, it was a devastating thing that I went on to prison. My mother died 6 months. I got there in Danbury, Connecticut. And I never could come back home because I didn't have the $4,000 to come back for the funeral. So I ended up, my case went worldwide with NPR radio station around the world, and everybody started writing, everybody started calling, everybody, and I started getting mail, and I gave hope to the people that I left behind. Because when you see a grandmother in prison, her daughter and her granddaughter, because the son refused to take the blame, and he put his own family in prison, that hurts to leave an 81-year-old grandmother there fighting. So I asked all the attorneys, if there is some way you can do is try and do some pro bono cases. Try and do something to help some of the people that I left behind. Because it's a struggle. Now it's like the prison after the prison. I was telling Mr. Gossett, so much happens. Here it is coming up Christmas. My purse got stolen last week. Everything I got was gone. I mean, it's like the devil's that I can't get a job because I'm a convicted felon. I can't work in nursing because I'm a convicted felon. And just last week, my daughter came to me, and she's now 18. She was 11 years old when I went to prison. He said, Mom, I want to tell you, I was molested while you was gone. If you had been home, this would never have happened to me. My son tried to kill himself 3 times while I was in prison. And my son now still goes to the drama, still trying to kill himself because he feel like he can't bring back what he's lost. I went to prison because I refused to testify with somebody. I hear people talk about being an addict. I never done drugs, so why should I have to go to prison and get help? I never sold drugs. There was no help in the prison system. Yes, there is a drama going on in the prison system. There's a war, a legalized slavery, because we got people incarcerated making 12 cents an hour for the job that you would do on the street for $30 an hour. And that's why the prison population is high booming right now. Because we are having people that are working, making cable lines, making computers for jobs that should be out here for us today. Yes, you get this knowledge in prison as being a computer specialist, but when you come out, I can't hire you because you are a convicted felon. I can't vote. I can't do anything. So all the doors are still closed in my face today, but I still have the spirit to go on and struggle and still fight for the people that I left behind, praying that one day somebody would give me a job. I had no house when I come home, no housing, no money, no nothing. But I thank God for my freedom. I thank God for President Clinton releasing me because it was on the faith of God. And people say, well, you know, if Bush had got, I feel like God, when he in control, he would have moved Bush to release me as well. That's the way I feel about the system. You know, and I look at the prosecutors, I look at the task force, I look at the police department. What we don't realize is everybody got a day to meet God. And when we mistreat people, regardless of you white, black, green, or purple, I might not see it, but I wouldn't want what I've done to you, hurt you, to follow my children or my children's children. So I ask people to be careful how you treat people. You know, don't just lie to get a case put in the court. You knowing that I lost everything, not only me, I speak for the people that I left behind that are in the same situation. I had a girl that called me. He said, Dorothy, my daughter was 7 years old when I went to prison. Now my daughter's 19 years old. She serves 30 years because she wouldn't testify on her boyfriend. And I commend seeing so many young people here. I tell you, be careful of your surroundings. Don't get caught up being in love. Don't get caught up because of who you're with. Your family will turn on you. The federal system is, you don't have to have evidence in federal prison. One person can say you had knowledge of. One person can say that you knew about it, and there will be a case brought you. You could face at least lifetime, and there is no parole in federal prison. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dorothy. That's an incredible story, and we're definitely blessed to have you here and have you on our side now. Now we're going to hear from Cliff Thornton. Did I get that right, Cliff?
That's right.
Okay.
I want to thank Andy Coe and all the other people that invited me here to talk to you about what is probably the most important social problem we will ever face in our life. I'm going to take you on a journey, my personal journey, about this drug war. As Elizabeth Taylor said to her seventh husband, I won't keep you long. Racism, classism, terrorism, and the war on drugs are inextricably parts of one huge lie. One cannot effectively address one part without addressing the others. I want to tell you about a journey that took me from a staunch drug warrior to a kinder, gentler, compassionate, truthful person advocating legalization, medicalization, and decriminalization. This journey began for me in 1963, 2 weeks before I was to graduate high school. One Sunday morning during breakfast, there was a knock at the door. Upon exchanging the usual pleasantries, my grandmother instructed me to accompany the gentleman. He was a police officer, and he drove me to a field of abandoned cars. Under one of them, there was the body of a naked woman. She was my mother, who had died of an apparent heroin overdose. Now, there's no words to describe how I felt, but one thought resonated as I came to my senses, and that was all illegal drugs should be eradicated from the face of the earth. The decades flew by. I watched the civil rights movement take center stage. Onward and upward was the battle cry. I watched the dismantling of the black community as I knew it into an even greater class divide. I watched as the findings of President Kennedy's Blue Ribbon Commission on illegal drugs went unheeded. They said that if the drug problem stayed in the hands of law enforcement, it would make the drug business more profitable, and enforcement would be concentrated in marginalized areas. They determined that drug use is an issue of public health, not law enforcement, and should be handled that way. I watched when I returned home on leave from the Army to bury my grandmother as race riots raged in my native Hartford, Connecticut. I left one war zone only to return to another, where the smell of marijuana was almost as strong as the tear gas. I watched as President Nixon declared the war on drugs on January 17, 1971. A few years ago, Dan Baum wrote a book called Smoke and Mirrors, which described these events very well. In the diary of H.R. Haldeman, one of Nixon's staff persons, Nixon is quoted as saying, "You have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to." And he said this about the Jewish population. And he's talking to H.R. Haldeman. He says, "You know, it's a funny thing. Every one of those bastards that are out for legalizing marijuana is Jewish. What the Christ is the matter with the Jews, Bob? What is the matter with them? I suppose it's because most of them are psychiatrists." Go figure. Gil Scott Heron, poet, singer, and composer of that time period, came up with a very catchy phrase about Nixon's staff, which went like this: "Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean. It follows a pattern, if you dig what I mean." Now, over three decades later, with Bush's staff, we have Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, Powell, and Rice. Not a damn thing has changed but the rollers of the dice. I watched as the French Connection became the Bolivian Connection, and then the Colombian Connection, and later the Afghanistan Connection, which will soon become the Uzbekistan Connection. I watched prisons fill up with drug offenders, most with black and brown faces. I watched as our health, education, economic, and criminal systems started to falter. I watched as two federal agents came to my place of employment and arrested one of my supervisors. I've known this guy for 10 years. This guy didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he didn't even have a girlfriend. Come to find out, he was introduced to a drug dealer, unbeknownst to him. The drug dealer gets busted, and in order for him to get leniency, he has to finger X number of people.
That's right.
He's now doing 10 years for bullshit. That next week, September 1997, I could no longer watch and not try and make a difference. I retired from my job. I have since dedicated my life to ending drug prohibition. Now, many people ask, why would you want to legalize something that killed your mother? Now, that gives me a real opportunity to explain in very real terms. I can say I watched as she used, watched as drug use and addiction stigmatized her and the crowd that she ran with. I can say I watched as my mother prostituted herself. I can say I watched her sleep all day. I can say I watched her hustle all night. I can say I watched her abandon my three brothers and me. I can say that it took some time to evolve to the state I am right now, and it was drug prohibition that killed her. To understand this war and to understand the problem of heroin in particular, one needs to grasp one core fact. Virtually every assertion testified to by the majority of politicians, criminologists, and medical personnel are unsupported by any sound evidence. Indeed, nearly all of it is now directly and entirely contradicted by tons of research from all over the world. The first casualty of this war is the truth, and yet after nearly 9 decades, this war continues. Shouldn't we be listening to the many voices which are now saying that continuing this drug war will be a grave threat to the long-term health of this nation? Drugs and fear go hand in hand. The war on drugs is frightening, but not in reality for the reasons which are claimed by its generals. The untold truth about this war that has now sucked in every country in the developed world creates the very problem which it claims to solve. The entire strategy is a hoax with the same effect as an Air Force which bombs its own cities instead of its enemies. We have to go to the trenches of the DARE program to find generals who have been so incompetent, so dishonest, so awesomely destructive toward those who they claim to care for. Executive Director Glenn Levant said of the studies against DARE, scientists tell you that bumblebees can't fly, but we know better. Besides, if we only reach one child, it's worth all the effort. Now let me ask you who are parents out there. Would you accept a math, English, or geography program that reaches only one child? I don't think so. The core point is that the death, sickness, and the so-called moral collapse which are associated with Schedule I drugs are in truth generally the result not of the drugs themselves, but of the black market on which they are sold as the result of the strategy of drug prohibition. The classic signs of social exclusion among addicts are the product not of their drug, but of the illegality of the drug. If addicts fail to work, it is not because heroin has made them work shy, but because they spend every minute of the day hustling. If addicts break the law, it is not because the drug has corrupted their morality, but because they are forced to steal and pay black market prices. If addicts are thin, it is not because the drug has stripped away their flesh, but because they spend every last cent on their habit and have nothing left for food. Over and over again, it is the black market which has been created by the politicians which does the damage. In comparison, the drugs themselves are relatively safe. We could turn around this epidemic of illness, crime, and death if we would only legalize, medicalize, and decriminalize them. We have to repeal this failed second prohibition. The moment the price of illegal drugs plummets, drug profits will collapse, and with them, the drug empires. I advocate regulating drugs, governmental constraints on sale to minors, or communities controlling these sale of drugs, quality controls to curtail overdose and prosecution of the inevitable bootleggers. Legalization is the precursor to regulation and control over drugs through state clinics and or stores. I say, legalize marijuana outright and tax the hell out of it. Make this available in state stores and also sell tobacco and alcohol out of these stores. We're always talking about sending the wrong message to our children. These stores would be the only place one could purchase these substances. This would cut the access tremendously for our children. Remove heroin from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 so doctors could prescribe and administer cocaine and heroin to addicts and counsel others who are thinking about using. This could be done at clinics. Using in public would be outlawed, just as drinking alcohol is in most places today. Advertising would be strictly prohibited. Driving, flying, piloting a vessel under the influence would still be punished. Taxes on marijuana would pay for enforcement, education, rehabilitation, research, jobs, training, and so forth. These monies would and should go back into those areas hardest hit by this drug war. After all, it is a problem created and sustained by the very laws themselves. Legalization would lead to an immediate decrease in murders, burglaries, and robberies. Though the spread of powerful weapons in the U.S. society and the proliferation of youth gangs has led to an addiction to gun violence that will not soon go away. But many predict that it would cut the illegal gun market in this country in half overnight. Cheap drugs would mean that most addicts would not be driven to crime to support their habit, and that drug lords would no longer have a turf to fight over. Legalization would remove the glamorous Al Capone-type traffickers who are role models for the young, and it would destroy the cool status of drug use. Drug legalization would cancel the corrupting role of drug cartels in South American politics, a powerful incentive to corruption at all levels of our own government, and a dangerous threat to our civil liberties through mistaken enforcement and property confiscation. It would scuttle a multi-billion dollar bureaucracy whose prosperity depends on not solving the drug problem, but perpetuating it. Some people argue that legalization represents a daring and risky experiment, but it is drug prohibition that is the daring and risky experiment. However, it is contemporary heresy to say this, and so the overwhelming evidence of this war's self-destructive futility is exiled from almost all public debate now, just as gay rights, slavery, and segregation once were. Take away the lies and the real danger becomes crystal clear. Not drugs, but the black market, which has been created directly by the policy of prohibition. If ever there is a war crimes trial to punish the generals who have gloried in this slaughter of the innocent, the culprits should be made to carve out in stone. There is no drug known to man which becomes safer when its production and distribution are handed over to criminals. Our problem is not the drug dealers or the drug cartels. They are just opportunists. Our problem is the self-righteous legislators in Washington and the apathetic non-voting public who create the opportunity for those dealers. Anyone who supports our present system of drug prohibition is directly responsible for these drugs in our school, these AIDS in our communities, and the creation and continuation of vast criminal empires. Heroin, marijuana, cocaine present no threat to me or to anyone else who chooses not to use them. But the illegality of these drugs presents a clear and present danger to everyone. Legalization of these handful of illegal drugs won't immediately remove the problems of drug abuse or drug addiction, but it will confine that problem to the people who choose to use these drugs. Then, and only then, is when the real work starts to solve the problems of drug abuse and drug addiction. That will make life better for everyone, and it's a reason for everyone to tell our politicians to end the hypocrisy, the partisanship, the divisiveness, the corruption, the racism and classism and cowardice that has characterized America's war on drugs. Thank you.